Today's Teisho will be on Case 38 in the Book of Serenity. Case 38 is entitled Lin Ji's True Man, or True Person. Introduction. Taking a thief for one's son, taking the servant for the master. Can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? Lin Ji said to the assembly, there is a true person with no rank always going out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look. Then a monk came forward and said, what is the true person of no rank? Lin Ji got down from the seat, grabbed him, and held him. The monk hesitated. Lin Ji pushed him away and said, the true man of no rank, what a dry piece of crap he is. Verse. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and the sand can't be cleared away. Clearing blocks off the eye from the sweet spring. If suddenly it burst forth, it would flow freely. So, thank you so much for coming to Practice Zen today. You know, it's important to practice meditation on your own. It's very important. If you only sit once a week, or even less than that, not much is likely to happen. So, meditation is really a matter of changing the way you could say, process information. So, you know, if you go through every day very stressed and very nervous, anxious, or angry, every time you go through a day like that, you're reinforcing those mental habits. You know, if you watch a lot of TV shows where people get shot, and you feel a visceral reaction of anger or satisfaction, you know, you're reinforcing those mental habits too. So, you know, all day long we're creating our mind. It's just a fact. We're creating our minds. We enter certain states that are familiar to us. We may not like them, but we continue to enter those states. So if you go through your day and all you think about all day is whether you're going to get fired or not, you know, that creates a deep set of mental habits that are very hard to get out of. If you're angry a lot, every time you get angry, you're reinforcing that your habit of being angry. You know, everything we do basically creates mental habits. And if you meditate, you know, at first it may be very challenging. You know, you may have a lot of problems when you sit down on a cushion. It may be hard for you to focus your mind. When you are not encountering the experience you expected, lots of responses can come up. So maybe when you're frustrated on the cushion, you feel angry. Or maybe you're anxious about your performance. You want it to be a good performance and you worry. And maybe when you meditate, you're actually having anxiety about whether you're really meditating properly. Believe it or not, that's more common than you would think. Some people actually get angry when they meditate. Being on a cushion, not moving, can trigger lots of associations that cause people to get angry sometimes. So, you know, when you're sitting on the cushion, it can be really challenging. But eventually, you will get to a place where your anxiety goes away, or your anger goes away, or your nervousness goes away. It may not happen every time you sit down, but if you do this regularly, if you do this regularly, you will have moments where you begin to feel really calm, grounded, even a little bit blissful. It will really happen to you. In most cases, this will happen, say, after like a couple months. It may not feel like the sky is opening up and angels are singing, but you may have moments where all your mental chatter recedes and you're in a kind of clearing. It's like being in a dense... The Buddha actually compared this to like going through a dense jungle and suddenly coming out into a clearing. And for a little while, you know, the sun is coming down onto the grass and there are no obstructions around you. You're not constantly pushing away vines or trying to dodge trees. It's just this open space. And it can be like that. It can open and go. You're back in the jungle wandering around. But little by little, if you practice this, you will get to a place where your mind is relatively still and unobstructed. And the thoughts won't totally vanish, but they'll be off to one side. Many people, when they reach this state, experience like relaxation. You know, we get into the state, many people feel like they can breathe, finally, right? And they feel maybe a sense of safety or well-being. If you have had that experience, it's because you've been, maybe you were just lucky, maybe you had it the first time you sat. But usually we have a lot of stuff to clear away before we can get to that place. And some meditation sessions are just, you know, clearing away the stuff. And it may be that in the last 5 minutes of a sit, you get there. And it may be the last 5 minutes of the third sit, you know. But eventually you will get there. And every time you get there, you're changing your mental habits. You know, you're changing your mental habits. Most people experience that kind of clearing in the jungle only once in a while, sometimes very, very rarely. You know, most people live lives of, actually, I think many people, maybe not all people, but most people live lives, I think, of almost constant mental distress. I really think that's true. You know, people have nowhere to rest their minds. You know, nowhere to rest the mind. You know, you go through a day where you're highly stressed, or you're anxious, or you're fearful, or you're angry. And at the end of the day, it's like, how can I rest, where can I rest my mind? Where can I put it down? And often there's no strategy for putting it down. You know, sometimes we'll go for a run, maybe you go for a jog and you reach a point where you're just exhausted. And actually, that's a very good thing to do if you're having a lot of problems with stress, because when you look at your mind, it's really quite empty. And that's actually not such a bad state. Running, exercise, not so bad. But many people do other things. Many people drink. And when you drink, you know, it does relax you. It does, actually in some ways like a depressant. And it relaxes you. And but your thoughts may or may not be still. Your mind may or may not be still. You know, your inhibitions are released. But meditation is really special because it's an opportunity for us to lay it down. You know, put the mind to rest somewhere. So it's like a bird that's flying and flying and flying and can't find any place to rest. And suddenly there's like this beautiful, beautiful glade and it can sit down and it's not going to be eaten. It's not going to be, you know, chased. You can sit down and rest. So every time you get to that place, it's very still, very grounded and safe. This is really healthy for you, really wonderful. And if you practice meditation often, you'll get to that place relatively often. You know, you can't control your meditation. So when you sit down on the cushion, there's no telling what's going to happen. And if you had a, if you meditate at the end of the day, if you had a difficult day, probably all you're going to do is work with the breath and try to sweep away sort of the remnants of your day. You may or may not get to that still place. If you meditate in the morning, it's easier to get there. This is why at Sesshins we get up so early. Because if you get up in the morning, you know, your mind has sort of done some of the sweeping away. And when you sit down, you can enter this, the clearing much more easily, you know. And if you do this regularly, you know, it is generally the case that you will get to that clearing more and more often, even though we can't control the process. And sometimes you'll sit down on the cushion, and from beginning to end, your mind is in distress, and you're working with the breath. And that's part of the practice, too, is working through your obstacles. And we all have them. So some sits are not going to be very rewarding, but the payoff will come later, in a later sit, where you get to that place that's calm and grounded, open, like a clearing in a forest. So the more you go to that place, the better, easier it will be for you to get back, and actually the better your life will be. Because, as I say, most people lead lives of constant mental distress with nowhere to put the mind down. And one of the wonderful things about meditation is it teaches people to find a place that's still and grounded. And this is infinitely precious, in my opinion. So if you practice meditation regularly, you will begin to be able to get to this place, and it's a tremendous resource. Now, if you've just had a terrible crisis in your life, and you try to take up meditation, it's not going to work, I'm sorry to say. So it might be better to take up jogging. But in the long term, meditation is actually better stress reliever than jogging, even though in the short term, jogging is better. The catch is you need to lay the proper foundation. So if you only meditate once in a while, you're not changing your mental habits. Your default position, your baseline mental state, will still be distress, anxiety, anger, cynicism, whatever's your baseline. But every time you sit down on the cushion and you get to this place, you're changing a little bit your baseline, your default setting on your mind. And eventually, you know, your default setting will change. You may not be able to maintain that clear, that grounded, calm mind all through the day, but when you do sit down on the cushion, you'll be able to get there with great regularity. And this is like, I think, if meditation did nothing else but that, it would be, I think, the most wonderful thing in the world. You know, so many people start doing meditation after reading books about Buddhism, and, you know, what they want is enlightenment, quote-unquote, you know, enlightenment. You know, when I started meditating, this was definitely my issue. You know, I read all of these books about these very famous, deeply enlightened Zen teachers. And I come from a period, I was in high school in the 1960s, and I went to college in the 1970s. And this is a period where this is like the psychedelic period, right? So lots of people wanted to experiment with consciousness. There was a lot of drug use, a lot of interest in yoga, and so on and so on. So, you know, lots of people read books about Yaqui Indian shaman in Mexico, and Tibetan lamas who could communicate through telepathy. And we wanted to have these mystical powers for ourselves. So lots of people got interested in meditation and Buddhism because of its possibility of reaching enlightenment. But actually, enlightenment, it's okay, right? It's a good thing. But really, something much more precious is this ability to put down your mental distress and be in a calm and centered place. This is priceless, right? Because most people haven't got access to such a place day after day, week after week, month after month, for as long as they live. So if you have aspirations to enlightenment, I think that's very important. But, please appreciate what happens when you sit on the cushion and you can enter this calm, grounded state. It's very precious. And every time you enter that state, you're changing your baseline consciousness. So it might happen to you that you start meditating on a regular basis. The best thing to do, I recommend, is to set aside a time. If you're starting to meditate, try to do this at least like 3 times a week. And have a set time. Like get up in the morning half an hour early and say, I'm going to wake up at 7 instead of 7:30. You can get up, you can have a cup of tea or something, sit down, meditate for half an hour, and then go about your day. And do that to start with like 3 times a week. And honestly, in no time at all, based on my own experience, I would say you'll begin to notice a change. As you're going through the day, you're less anxious. You feel more confident in your ability to handle your problems. Your mind is less likely to fly off into a panic. You're more grounded. And part of it is just knowing that you can get to this calm, centered place when you need to. Part of the confidence that comes when you meditate is knowing you can get to that place when you need to. See, so if you begin to practice this, and you do it like 3 times a week, you will begin to notice a change in your daily life. And eventually, for most people, if you begin to make this a routine, you will actually find yourself looking forward to sitting down on the cushion. You will. And when you don't sit, you'll begin to miss it. This will really happen to you if you just hang in there long enough. You'll notice if you don't meditate that you're a little bit more sharp-tempered. You're a little bit angrier under the surface, or you're a little bit more anxious. And when you meditate, at first, it's difficult to sit down on the cushion. It's so hard to sit down on the cushion that it doesn't really make any sense, does it? I mean, you sit in a chair all day long. No, you never meet anybody going into their office and they look at their chair and say, oh, I just can't sit in that chair today. I mean, I guess that happens sometime. But mostly we just sit down in a chair. But sitting on a cushion is a different thing. You say, I'm going to meditate today. And then you look at your cushion and you think, well, I'll do it tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes, but you're too busy tomorrow, so you don't meditate tomorrow either. Something very profound is going on when we, quote-unquote, can't meditate. It's like there's something going on that we don't want to face, maybe, about ourselves. But at any rate, if you begin to practice meditation regularly, it will begin to be a pleasant experience. If you can just get yourself to the cushion 3 times a week, you'll begin to notice that you get into this grounded, balanced place more and more regularly, more and more predictably. And your emotional distress will go away when you're meditating. And when you go through the day, it's almost, honestly, I mean, it can be like a magic charm. You'll notice that you're calmer, less anxious, less angry, and you'll notice that when you don't meditate, some of those mental habits come back. So, if you want to practice Zen, it's very important, or you want to practice any kind of Buddhism, it's very important to do it regularly and to change your mental habits by reinforcing certain key experiences that we have on the cushion. And eventually you might begin to be a person like this. You know, maybe you'll get up maybe five times a week. You'll get up at 7 o'clock, you'll do your meditation, you'll get off the cushion, you'll take a shower, you'll get to work. You know, people will see you at work and they'll think, who is that person who's so happy and friendly, right? Your boss will give you a big problem and you'll solve it, and you'll turn in your work and with a smile, and you'll be calm, and this could actually happen. You know, it will improve your life. It definitely did this for me. It helped me enormously. You know, you may have a long way to go. You know, so when I started meditating, I definitely was suffering from depression. So it took me a while to get to this state. You know, I had to go through a lot of sits where I was struggling, you know, struggling. But eventually, I looked forward to sitting. I really did. I loved it. And I would, actually look forward to getting on the cushion because I would feel better and I could carry it through the day. So humans have this capacity if they only use it. And the great tragedy is that, you know, people don't always use it. It's this wonderful thing that's always there. So, you know, you might become this kind of a person who gets up at 7 in the morning, does his zazen or does her zazen, goes, catches the bus, catches the train, gets in the car, drives to work, goes through the day, and you could say, you know, this is wonderful, this is wonderful. And you could say, I am so happy that I have encountered Zen or that I have encountered Buddhism. I really understand Buddhism now. So, you know, that would be true to some degree, but not entirely true. You know, please do all of those things. And if you can get to the place I just described, that will be wonderful, wonderful. You have this capacity to ground yourself, okay? But you know, if that was the limit of your practice, something would still be missing from your practice. Something would still be missing from your practice. And I'm not sure people fully appreciate this. I can't help but think that Americans are extremely isolated people. I was reading about the decline in membership in like organizations and clubs among college students, you know, and it's pretty dramatic. I was just reading this study, and it was just saying that in the 1960s. College students were in X number of clubs and organizations, and since then it's been a downhill curve. And they were saying that, you know, today's college students, maybe it's because they have to work and they're under other pressures, but much more isolated than college students in the 1960s. Many fewer connections. And there's a lot of evidence of other kinds, too, that suggests that Americans are extremely lonely people, lonely and isolated people. And I think that's very interesting and sad, but also very important. You know, how do we get like this? You know, Buddhism arose at an interesting time. Interesting time. I've just been reading about the history of Buddhism. You know, Buddhism arose in India at a time when people were moving from small villages to cities. This actually was the case. You know, we might think of a Buddhism as arising in the jungle. You know. But actually, Buddhism arose at a time in history when lots of people were like leaving their villages and going into cities. They were leaving their ancestral little hamlets, right? Their little towns, because there was nothing there but planting rice. And they would go into cities and they would become silversmiths or accountants or, you know, teachers or nurses. All these new professions were arising. And the Buddha arose at this time, you know. And Buddhism came out of this world. And that's interesting to me. You know, there's something wonderful, actually, about, I think, about what was happening to people. It's like, you know, when you go to college, it's a wonderful thing in certain ways, right? I mean, if you grow up, I grew up in not a small town, but I grew up on military bases. And they're like a small town, only worse, right? Because everybody knows each other. And it's a very claustrophobic environment, you know. So, if your father is an admiral, you're actually thought of more highly than another kid whose father is only a lieutenant. So it's like you have your father's rank if you're growing up in a military base. So you wouldn't mess with the admiral's kid, see, because he's the admiral's kid. It's like the king's kid, right? So, you know, small towns, you know, we sentimentalize small towns, but, you know, small towns can be very unpleasant places in a lot of ways. You know, people know each other in sort of a bad way, right? Everybody's judgmental of everybody else. Everybody's supposed to play the social roles. You know, if you're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do that. If somebody does something a little out of the ordinary, it becomes a subject of gossip, right? This kind of atmosphere is a little bit stifling, right? And even our own families can be a little bit like this. You know, I loved my brother and my sister. I loved my mother. She's no longer alive. Getting out of my family was really a great experience, right? Getting out of the military, off military bases, and realizing that people could live a totally different way was really an exciting experience. You know, when you come to college, you leave your family, you leave your town, and you come to a place like New Brunswick, and you meet all kinds of people. All kinds of people. You know, so if you're from rural New Jersey, if you're from the south of New Jersey, you know, Vineland or someplace like that, and you come to Rutgers, you know, you meet kids from the city, from New York, which you probably never went to. You know, and I love Rutgers. If you look at Rutgers, it's like the United Nations. You have Indian Americans, Pakistani Americans, Korean Americans. What a wonderful world, right? What a wonderful world. And there's all of these different people. Well, you know, I think Buddhism arose at the same time. You know, people were saying, let me out of this little town. I want a bigger life. And they were going to the city, you know, but they were going to the city. And it's like going to college. You know, you meet people who are totally different, who have different values, different outlooks. You know, the potential is so great, isn't it? When people leave their little worlds behind and they meet each other and they can have a big world, right? A bigger world. You know, I'll never forget, you know, when I first ate Indian food. It was like a revelation. What is this food? You know, now I eat it every day, just about. I love Indian food, you know. I'll never forget when I first, read Li Bao's poetry. It blew my mind. Or the first time I read the Bhagavad Gita. It was just like, what the hell is this? This is wonderful. So, you know, meeting other people from far away, or different people, is this wonderful thing. But, you know, I look at college students today, and they're very isolated. Americans are very isolated. So, you know, it's like we've all left home, so to speak. But we're in the big city, so to speak. But we can't take advantage of this opportunity, see, because of our fears and our anxieties. You know, so, you know, people in the city can be more isolated than they were when they were in their little towns, see? Because they don't know how to get out and connect. See? And it's the same thing at college. You know, you leave your little town in New Jersey where everybody's the same, and you come to Rutgers, and there's all these different people, but you know, you may never be able to get out of yourself and connect. So, you know, people think of Buddhism. They think of Buddhism as a solitary activity you do to, you know, sort of like improve your mental processing. And there, that's definitely true. That is a dimension of Buddhism. See? But there's another dimension of Buddhism. You know, I think what the Buddha was trying to do was give people the equipment to live in a bigger world, to meet the stranger without fear and with like an open heart, an open mind, open heart. So have all these people, you know, all these people from all over suddenly moving into the city. And they all have like country ways, right? You know, if you go down to South Jersey, I don't want to insult South Jersey too much. But you know, those people down there are hicks, you know, if I may say so. You know, I have encountered a lot of racism in South Jersey, you know. People drive around with Confederate flags on their car. They have a mental attitude which is fearful of strangers. You know, you think in Jersey they would be more cosmopolitan, right? But they're not. They'd never go to the city. They live down in their enclaves down there, and they might as well be, with all due respect, in Alabama. You know, so these people have provincial minds, fearful of the different, fearful of what's not like what they know. See, so one way to think about Buddhism, yes, you know, the Buddha wanted people to have less stress. He wanted people to be grounded. He wanted people to be, you know, centered. But I think he had a bigger objective. You know, he was trying to give people the tools to live a bigger life with each other. See, all these people left their towns and they came to the city, and they're all like atoms bouncing around. See, all like individual, lonely individuals in the city. See, and Rutgers is full of lonely students at the university. And the reason they're so lonely, partly, is that they're online all the time. But that's a symptom, isn't it? I mean, the internet is trying to solve a social and psychological problem with technology, and that never works, right? So people sit and they Facebook each other, and I've learned how to use Facebook too. I'm quite proud of it. Nevertheless, it's no substitute for meeting people in the flesh, right? And Facebook is so safe. It should be called Safebook. See, because you can't be rebuffed. You can't have unpleasant experiences. There's no element of uncertainty. There's no risk, no emotional risk. With all due respect, it's a nerd's idea of interaction. It is. Facebook is a nerd's, a lonely nerd's fantasy of social interaction. So you know, I think lots of people in the modern world are lonely and isolated. Even they've left their homes, they're in the city. And I think the Buddha was dealing with people like this. And he said, you know, why are you so lonely? Why are you so isolated? You know, you can have connection. You can have a bigger life. You know, if you think about it, almost all the problems we have in the United States, America has an epidemic of psychological problems, and they're almost all disorders of isolation. You know, we're told to be competitive, and that pits us against each other all the time. And, you know, we're constantly judging ourselves in the harshest terms because we don't measure up to some social standard. So we go about really ashamed to encounter other people. You know, I think this is our social and psychological landscape. You know, so we're all very lonely and isolated. We don't know how to get out. And I think the Buddha was dealing with people just like that. Rootless cosmopolitans who didn't know how to reach out. And you know what? You know, in Buddhism, there's three jewels. There's Buddha. Everybody gets Buddha. There's Dharma. Everybody gets Dharma. But you know, Sangha. People, especially Americans, they don't get Sangha. Right? They just, what's that? You know, that's like a club. I don't join clubs. I don't join clubs. And I myself don't join clubs. But nevertheless, you know, nevertheless, the Buddha didn't say there's two jewels. He said there's three jewels. You know, I think Sangha was very important to the Buddha. You know, in one of the sutras, somebody says, well, Lord Buddha, what about friendship? Is that important in your philosophy? And the Buddha says, friendship? He says, that's the whole point. That's Buddha actually said that. He actually said, friendship, that's the point of the Dharma. See, friendship is what it's all about. Human connection is what it's all about. You know, if you look at all the forms of mental distress that are typical of Americans, the depression, the anxiety disorders, and so on and so on, they're all connected, they're all produced by social isolation. So, you know, it's possible to look at, if somebody walked into this room and saw all these people sitting on their mats with their eyes closed, you know, somebody would say, well, that's isolation. But it's really not. You know, Buddhism is really not. It's about creating a person who is capable of overcoming his or her isolation and being connected to others. Meditation is about creating a person who can have rich social relationships with other people, loving, compassionate connection. And so meditation is all about encountering our inner obstacles and opening up. And this is the essence. So meditation is not just about, please do get up three or four or five times a week on your own and meditate. Please do. And it will help you go about your life. But there's something more to Buddhism than that. See, there's still something missing, which is, you could say, Sangha. And it doesn't necessarily mean coming here, but the whole world is your Sangha. If you go to the city, you can't take advantage of the city, so to speak. You can't take advantage of the university if you're crippled by your fears and your anxieties and so on. So one of the things that meditation does is it teaches us how to work through our fears and anxieties and open up to the unexpected, open up to the stranger, however the stranger presents itself. See? So this koan is really important. This is, you know, one of the most important koans. You know, Lin Ji is a basically a very famous teacher of Chinese Chan, Zen. And Lin Ji said to the assembly, there is a true person with no rank going out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not witnessed it yet, look. See, so look, what is this person of true rank? See, now, you know, none of us are maybe by nature cosmopolitans. I love this word, cosmopolitan. Do you know that word? It means a person who is at home in the cosmos. See? So a person who is at home in the cosmos is a cosmopolitan. You know, a person who can go to France and interact in a relaxed and friendly and interested way with Frenchmen, can go to the Bronx and interact at home in the world. See, Paris, the Bronx, Scottsdale, Arizona. You know, there are such people, right? There are such people. And you know, there is a person who is a true cosmopolitan, who is always open to the often open to the possibilities offered by the stranger, by the unfamiliar. See, that's the man of Zen, or the woman of Zen, is a true cosmopolitan. See, we think we have limits, right? You know, we live in our heads, in our isolation, a little bit too much because we don't really know that we're actually this wonderful cosmopolitan. We think we're this hick from the sticks. You know, it's hard to get out of our shells. It's hard to get past our anxieties. It's hard to get past our mental loops, right? You know, I have a friend. I have a good friend who is an amazing artist. She is, some of her paintings just and drawings are so impressive. It's just amazing. And yet this person has a real block. You know, sometimes, I'll say, "Are you painting these days?" And she says, "Oh no. You know, I've got to. My house has looked so dingy. I have to paint the walls of my house, or the plaster's cracked, and I have to fix that. And then I'll call, and it's something else, and it's something else. You know. Basically, this is a really wonderful artist who's held back by something in herself, right? She's held back. And, you know, I told her last time I talked, she said, "The plaster on my wall is cracked." I said, "Why don't you paint a picture of the plaster on your wall instead of fixing and painting the wall?" But you know, we all are self-limiting in various ways. Me too. You know, we're all self-limiting in various ways because we think this is who I really am. This is who I really am. It's hard for me to do this. That's just not, you know, this. I'm not. That's not who I really am. See, it's hard for me to leave Freehold, New Jersey and go to Rutgers. I'm really a Freehold person. That's too bad. Right? That's too bad because the world's bigger than Freehold, New Jersey. It's bigger than Vineland, right? I'm really a Vineland person, a girl. It's, oh, that's too bad. It's nice to go to, I was in Perth Amboy the other day. Really nice. It's just one town on planet Earth, right? Very nice. I don't think I would want to limit myself to Perth Amboy, you know. So we don't have to, but we create these mental structures. You know, I couldn't do that. I'm uneasy with strangers. Or I don't think I could, you know, I don't think that's me, you know. So Linji's saying, look, that's not you. You know, that's your image of you. That's your imagination of you. You know, don't hold yourself back. Don't close yourself down. You know, there's a big world out there. You don't have to live in isolation. Isolation is a mental habit of closing the doors around us. So, you know, in China, when Lin Ji was around, basically everybody had a role and a rank, right? So everybody had a role and a rank. You know, if you were a peasant, you were a peasant. That's it. That's who you are. If you were a landowner, you were a landowner. That's who you were. See, so everybody had like a rank. Or a standing status. And Lin Ji came along and said, "Screw that." You know, basically, nobody's just a peasant. Nobody's just a this, just a that. Nobody's essentially anything. You know, get off your ass and get out into the world. See, Lin Ji also said something else, by the way. You know, in China, in Chinese culture, reverence for your mother and your father is basically the highest virtue in the Confucian system. And Lin Ji said, you know, you should kill your mother and your father. Imagine saying that in China. You know, people, their jaws dropped open. That's one of the. He even said, if you meet the Buddha, kill. He said, if you meet your mother, kill your mother. If you meet your father, kill your father. And if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. So what he's saying is, don't. These are all artificial barriers. You don't have to be like your mother. You don't have to be like your father. You know, if your father was a potter, you don't have to make pots. You know, if your father was a blacksmith, you don't have to be a smith. You know, if you grew up in Vineland, you don't have to stay in Vineland. And you know, the old saying, you can take the person out of Vineland, but you can't take the Vineland out of the person. Well, that's the bigger problem, right? How do you take the Vineland out of the person? How can you be a real cosmopolitan at home in the universe? See, so sitting three times a day or five times a day on your own is very important. But it's not everything. And coming to sit with other people is usually a deeper experience. There's the collective energy of practicing together. That's formidable. Many people say to me, I sit better with other people. The collective energy of practicing together is really wonderful, right? You know, there are many other aspects to practicing together which are really quite magical and wonderful. You know, even though we sit together wordlessly, I think this is, in some ways, meditating together is one of the most intimate things people can do, really and truly. You know, one of the problems with Zen centers, if you know anything about the history of Zen centers, is that a lot of people wind up sleeping with each other, and this is not necessarily a good thing. You know, basically people come to Zen centers and soon there is some sleeping going on, right? Sleeping with others going on. And this has created many, many problems, and it's something I don't think is a good idea. But I understand why it happens. Because if you go to a sesshin with somebody, you know, by day seven of sesshin, all your barriers are down. You are totally open, you know. And you need other kinds of rules to, you need to follow the precepts. Absolutely. You need other new rules now. And those are the precepts. So please follow the precepts all your life. Please. There's a kind of intimacy that happens in a zendo when people sit together, which is like nothing else in the world. You could talk for 20 hours together. But when you go through a sesshin together, you know, by day seven, you're totally open. It's like the doors have been blown off. People sometimes close them again by making bad decisions, and then they have to go to another sesshin. So, wonderful, wonderful intimacy on the cushion when you practice with other people. We don't want to abuse it. We want to use it in the proper way, which is to be compassionate people. But it's a miracle that it happens. So, anyway, Linji said to the assembly, there is a cosmopolitan in you. There's a cosmopolitan, a citizen of the universe in you, if you can just open your doors and be intimate with the world wherever you go. Beginners who have not witnessed this yet, look. Okay, and then a monk came forward and said, you could imagine this monk being kind of a smartass, right? Who the hell is this man of no rank? Or maybe the monk was feeling insecure, and he said, who is this? Who is this? I can't even imagine a cosmopolitan like that. You know, I'm so locked up in myself. You know, I can't even imagine being like that. So Linji got down from the seat, grabbed him, and held him. He slaps him. Right? He slaps him. It's you, damn it! It's you. The monk hesitated. So Linji pushed him away and said, "The true man of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is." It's not, that was Linji's style. And I'm sure this person finally woke up. Verse. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. See, so that poor monk, you know, he's still trapped in his South Jersey mind, right? But he's really a cosmopolitan. He just doesn't know it yet. You know, if you just keep practicing, you will discover your cosmopolitan self. It's like spring. You know, the flowers just naturally open in spring. It will be just like that. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. And, you know, with the right power, you can pull 9 bulls in one yank. It seems hopeless. The mud and the sand can't be cleared away. But one day it will suddenly burst forth and freely flow. Yeah, I promise.